Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
Hello, I'm Matt Bush, the news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio, and I produce Going Deep along with the Shoups. This is our second annual Super Bowl episode, and in this show, we examine on and off the field issues in the NFL heading into Super Bowl 53, at least those that don't have anything to do with the officials. We covered them in our last episode, and I encourage you to go back and listen to that show when you're done with this one. We start Going Deep today by asking a similar question ahead of Super Bowl 53 that we did before Super Bowl 52 last year. What effect the Take a Knee protests spearheaded by former 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick are having, not just on the NFL, but society at large.
We need to make a distinction between what the kind of mainstream media coverage was and what is still happening, because there are still players that are involved in this conversation. Even at the beginning of the season, there was some, you know, dust up around players kind of calling each other out around their integrity on these questions.
Malcolm Jenkins and Eric Reed, there was a fight,
right,
almost during your fight.
And it was about integrity. Your integrity around these demands and, you know, quote unquote, selling out when your charity got money or whatever. So those conversations, I guarantee you, have not gone away. But what happened was there was a crackdown by almost all the owners. There was, I'm sure there was some backdoor conversations, backroom conversations about media coverage. The president of the United States issued his disapproval of it. And there was some, at least anecdotal conversations around that that people were not going to watch if players took a knee and things like that. And interestingly enough, in a league where 70% of the players are African American, most of the people who watch NFL football are white. So I think The conversation didn't go away, but what happens, we see this over and over again, it is a pattern in our country. White people get uncomfortable, people of color get silenced. So we see the same thing happening in this situation. These men are paid employees. Their employer told them to shut up. And so they have a decision to make. But I guarantee you that the dialogue, the discourse, the issues, the yearning to provoke justice around these issues is still just as live for those players, because it's just as live as it's ever been in our country. This is all about power, and there was a power play, and for now, it's quieted it down. It's not gone away.
I also don't think that it's coincidental that of the 8 head coaches that lost their jobs at the end of the season, 5 of them were African Americans. And as we're recording this show right now, only 2 of the 32 teams in the NFL have an African American head coach. Those are steps back. Those are steps backwards. And well, I guess I just don't think that that's a coincidence. All of this is related.
Well, and that's about power, too. And there's a recent article in Forbes magazine about how there's all this attention on the coaches of color losing their jobs, and not, you know, that now we're down to 2 out of 32. But quietly behind the scenes, there are also people that have been in upper management who are people of color, who are either retiring or being let go, and those are less visible things, but it's all about the distribution of power. And again, that is a very common strategy in a society where there where power is racialized, that when things start to become unsettled or power seems to begin to shift, there are too many of you in the room. There's too many. It happens in churches. It happens in universities. It happens in politics. And I think it's definitely happened in the NFL. Nobody has to say it out loud, but the people who have the most power can make it happen. And this last two seasons and going into whatever happens next season has not been good for people of color who make their living in the NFL, no matter how you cut it.
I think one of the problems that the NFL is having, and it's going to come to a head soon, is that the NBA is navigating this culture really deftly,
in a much better way.
And I promise you, the NFL players see that. I mean, LeBron James is the face of an athlete working towards social justice.
Say probably the most famous athlete in the world right now.
Yes, I would say.
And obviously nobody's telling him to shut up.
No.
Right. And that's a model that every player in that league is looking at right now and wondering, man, why do I got to dress like this? Why do I got to wear this? Why do I have to do this? What? Whereas in the NBA, they're allowed to do that. Silverman, the commissioner of the NBA, has really done a good job of talking with the players, being collaborative, and they're just navigating this whole cultural
And there are more people
scenario.
Of color in positions of power and decision-making in the NBA.
I was going to say, how much this comes, there are a few black owners in the NBA. Not many, but there are some.
But
there are none in the
in
NFL.
In the NFL.
And
there are more black head coaches in the NBA.
Yeah. And the talk of getting, when the Carolina Panthers came open or went up for sale, there was talk. Puff Daddy was the one leading the charge saying, I want to buy the Panthers and bring in other people with that, Stephen Curry, some others, to make that the first black-owned team in the NFL. And that went away. We've been talking about this last year in our Super Bowl episode, now that I think of it. That went away very quickly. That was just gone, and we have another white owner. How much does that play into it?
Oh, huge amount. I mean, this is, again, people, they like to individualize issues of race. Like, I'm not a racist, or I don't use racial slurs, or we all get along in the locker room. Race and racism is about power. You have to do a power analysis of any organization to understand what's happening with race in that organization. And what's happening in the NFL around race is a silencing, is a chastening, is a, you know, you got out of your place, you need to get back in it. And I think it has everything to do with who's at the table when they're discussing these strategies, when they're discussing what they're going to do to solve a problem. If it's all white men around a table, then those are the perspectives that are going to be privileged. It's just, that's just human nature. There's no way around that. And from what we've heard anecdotally about some of those conversations around the management table in the NFL is that the people who were the kind of outliers or who said we should really let the players have more agency in this, they were squashed. So, I mean, I think it's just not what's trending in the powers and principalities of the NFL.
Yeah, and what's you could see it clearly with powerful positions of head coaches and that number being reduced. And this racism isn't isn't Jim Crow laws that have signs up separating the two, or it's not a hood of the Ku Klux Klan. It's very stealth, though, but very, I think, organized. I really do, from the people in power. And it's very evident.
The NFL held up the Rooney Rule when it sort of went into effect in the last decade of, this was something we put on the books that shows that we're going to try to increase diversity within at least the head coaching ranks. Since that's been in effect, we now have fewer black head coaches. Again, yeah. We're down to two right now. Through the next sort of hiring process, maybe there may be some more get to that, but two out of 32 as we speak.
Well, the Rooney Rule is a double-edged sword, and I know you've got...
And just to clarify for our listeners, the Rooney Rule was put into effect in the last decade. It requires NFL teams, when they hire their head coaches, to interview at least one minority candidate. Mm-hmm. One person of color as a candidate was named for the former Steelers owner, Dan Rooney.
And I want to pause right here, and I want to just say out loud, this is not going to be a popular thing for me to say, but the Rooney Rule has created a shield for racist practices, because all we got to do is bring in one person and then we can check that off the list. Who were the Cleveland Browns talking about bringing in? Condoleezza Rice. I mean, this is a joke. I mean, I think the double-edged sword of a rule like the Rooney Rule, it's not just the Rooney Rule. Again, we see this strategy in a lot of different institutions in our country, is that it creates... it creates situations where if a person of color fails, it only is affirming stereotypes. And it is only then making it more predictable that a person of color will not get another head coaching job. There are perceptions there. There's a whole lot of training and experience that goes into being somebody who's ready for one of those jobs. And when John was in the league, they were talking about some of those things with getting people in coordinator positions and things like that. That's what you need to look at. Those are the people that really are going to be able to step into those positions and be successful and then begin to actually change perception. Otherwise, it only kind of makes the cycle more acute. And would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. I have friends, African-American friends, who were interviewed for positions and felt like that was an inauthentic interview. They were just checking something off the list. And I understand their disappointment as much as I can. When I was in the NFL, you're right. What I really argued was what we need to do is work really hard to have quality control coaches that are people of color. And then not just running back coaches or defensive line coaches, but now quarterback coaches who are people of color who become the offensive coordinators. If you don't have a pool of African-American quarterback coaches and offensive and defensive coordinators, then you're not going to have a pool of head coaching candidates. And the head coaching candidates that you do have are going to be set up for failure. My argument while I was in the NFL and in college even, I used to say in college, let's allow one more coach on a staff, provided that coach is a person of color. You're allowed two GAs, now you're allowed four GAs. I used to say, let's allow five if three of them are people of color, or if at least a certain number are. That's the way you're going to create a pool of candidates. If you're not intentional about creating a pool of qualified candidates, there's something inauthentic about saying, we're just going to interview guys. And frankly, there were even guys that I knew who interviewed, and I'm like, oof, I love that guy, but he ain't ready to be a head coach.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's sort of like a track to being a head coach, because I've heard you talk about this before off mic, about you were on that track. Mm-hmm. You were a quality control. I was going to say quality assurance. Yeah. Similar. And then to a quarterback coach, then to an offensive coordinator. Right. And we had just previously talked about the significance of the quarterback to the organization. Obviously, the quarterback coach, it's similar, right?
Right. And so, you know, those are the real intricate thinking positions that, you know, on offense, it's the quarterback and offensive line really do a lot of the game planning and scheming. And on defense, it's kind of right up the middle. The middle linebacker and the safeties coach. If you coach the safeties or the middle linebacker, then your next step is going to be to being a coordinator. And when I was in the league and in college, I used to always say, those are the positions to create a pool of candidates to be coordinator and then head coach. We got to pay attention to that. And then in a generation later, you'll be surprised how many amazing African-American head coaches there are. Obviously, I'm not in the NFL and kind of got kicked out of college, so.
On our Super Bowl 54 episode next year, what might be the saying about race?
It probably depends on what we're talking about in the larger culture.
But right. We have an election year next year, and I think obviously a lot of the issues that are underlying right now are only going to come out even more in an election year.
And we definitely, in the last political election, definitely people of color, you know, really made a statement. And there's much more diversity in the House of Representatives now. So some of those things the pendulum could be swinging back a little bit. I think a lot of it is going to depend on what the players' union prioritizes in the coming year. They have power. They have to decide how to use it. There are a lot of issues on the table right now that are impacting players' lives. You know, people have gotten distracted. They're not reading as much about head injury settlements and all the concussion lawsuits and stuff. There's still so much going on with head injuries that needs to change. So how are they going to prioritize? How are they going to use their cards, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that we didn't say in the discussion a few minutes ago is, I don't know all the backstory, but I'm assuming the players' union did not prioritize the anthem issue, mm-hmm. or it perhaps wouldn't be as muted as it is now.
Well, I know there's a labor issue coming up I don't know if it's 2020 or 2019, but there's a very serious threat of a player strike coming, and these players have gotten so good that I can't see scabs filling in or anything like they did in the mid-80s. Right. And I think the players are going to have an awful lot of power, because people like Deshaun Watson, Patrick Mahomes, these young quarterbacks that are just phenomenal, Andrew Luck, just absolutely phenomenal players, people want to see them. People want to see them and gamble on them. They don't want to see, scab players come in and go away.
You used a word there that I'm going to go on there, and that's gambling. To go again, look at it a little differently. Now, we've talked before about the changes in fandom that fantasy sports and gambling has sort of created. Does this give the players more power because of the popularity of gambling, because of the popularity of fantasy sports, and that people put so much time, effort, and money into their fantasy teams, so that was 1987 was the year with the replacement players, that they might not fly now, because no one's really going to want to see that. They want to see the guys on their fantasy team playing.
This next labor negotiation is going to be a knockdown dragout for sure. And people like Drew Brees, who's very strong in the players' union, in Tom Brady, not as much, but they're at the end of their careers where they don't have as much to lose now as well. So they'll have a strong voice going out, and then there's players that people are going to be dying to see and bet on. I think that's going to be the next really big thing on the horizon of the NFL. Another interesting thing to keep your eye on is there's a couple of new leagues that are formulating, and whether it's the Alliance of America Football League, whether it's the Pacific Pro Football League, or whether it's the XFL, I don't know if any of those will really grow roots and make it, but they might be a model for how to gamble in a new way that the NFL ends up pouncing on. I think one of the next big things, too, is going to be the in-stadium experience and how you can gamble in ways that you can gamble on your phone or however you might do it while you're at the game, not just on winners or losers, but play to play. I mean,
and these,
as the game is rolling.
And these other leagues might introduce some of that in their in-stadium experiences, and that might be attractive to fans to come in and see a game like that. And I think also by the time 2020, the NFL will have a team in Las Vegas at that point. That's when the Raiders will be there, if not earlier.
And there will be some gambling there.
I would imagine there'll be some gambling there, right? I mean, one or two.
If they do go on strike and there are these other leagues and everything, I think never underestimate how reactive people are to people of color who make a lot of money thinking they should make more money. Again, that's a big carrier of racism. There's a narrative. It's deeply embedded in America's economy that people of color should just be thankful for whatever it is they're making. So I hear you about the players' union strike and all that, but I do think, go back to, remember, it's a majority of white people that are gambling, that are playing fantasy football, that are watching football, and they are not going to have a good taste in their mouth. Even if it means I'm going to get this little-known quarterback on my team that's a scab player, I would not be surprised if that, if their kind of distaste for entitled people of color, they'll never say that out loud, but would overshadow, okay, I'll play with this scab player. So, and plus, I'm wondering, too, as I listen to you, like, what impact these other leagues emerging are going to have on the NFL's players' union. Like, if that's going to...
I mean, the dynamic is now the players' union, the NFL, is the weakest of the four major leagues. Because pretty much of the two strikes that happened in the 80s, the union was broken, particularly the last one, and the last large-scale one in 1987, where there were replacement players. But also, you know, the NFL has just left a litter of leagues that tried to challenge it in its wake. So to think maybe the union could get wins or that one of these leagues might stick for a year or two or really have some sort of impact that's a stretch to say that it might happen. But
it's a big question.
There are some at least differences in, you know, maybe the conditions around the game right now that maybe might make it different. Or the same thing could happen that happened in the mid-'80s with USFL and the 1987 strike.
It'll be interesting to see.
We had this dynamic this year. Again, we have sort of a mix in the Super Bowl of an old gun and a young gun. But you mentioned the popularity of some of the newer quarterbacks, particularly Patrick Mahomes of the Kansas City Chiefs. Where might we go when we see the sort of passing of, you know, this one generation of quarterbacks of Brady and the Mannings and Roethlisberger and Rivers and Breeze, and we go to this next generation of the Watsons and Mahomes and Goffs and Trubiskys? What effect is that going to have on the game when you have this sort of generational passing of the torch, I guess, is for the lack of a better term.
As a fan watching it, I'm ultra excited. I mean, Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes are must-watch TV to me. And so I'm really excited about that. I think one of the things that's important is that high school football is getting so big, and players are playing year-round. And we're watching now things that we've never seen before. True freshmen are going and winning national championship games. We've seen it the last 2 years. And what's going to happen is Patrick Mahomes is in his second year now in the NFL, just his second year. And he probably had the greatest season ever statistically. And so these players are getting so much better in high school and in college that whenever they come to the NFL, they're so ready to go. And then you couple that with guys like Drew Brees and Tom Brady that are playing into their 40s as well. You just wonder how long these guys are going to be able to last. You know, if Patrick Mahomes has a season like that in his second season, can he play 18 seasons like these guys are going on now?
Even in our culture at large, there's a generational, let's say, battle right now. But there is friction, to put it mildly, I think, particularly between the baby boomers and the millennials. This is just a way of showing it. I mean, in our culture in general right now, there is an old versus new dynamic that's really popping up. And I'm just curious, as we look at it in football, culturally in the United States too, this also exists, and where that may be going in the next few years as we see one generation sort of walk off the stage and another one begin to take its seat more prominently.
Well, the other thing I'd like to say is some of the young quarterbacks that are rising in the NFL, Mahomes and Andrew Luck and Deshaun Watson, couple their amazing talent with their unbelievable guys. They're really well-liked in their community. They're really well-liked by their teammates. And so I think that's an important thing, too. Drew Brees and Tom Brady aren't going to look at these young guys and think, what jerks, they don't get it. These guys approach the game with the respect that kind of the game deserves, and I think that's admirable. And I think that's learned as well.
I also think there's a mirror around, again, if we look at the political arena, this new generation of people are just more wide open. They're not, you know, they're not kind of measuring everything they say. They're not putting their finger up to take the temperature and looking at polls. They're saying, this is right and this is wrong, and I'm going to do what's right. And I think that kind of more outspoken, like, this is who my authentic self is sort of mirrored. I mean, you watch Mahomes play. He just has such a feel, like, all, you know, just the all the different ways he can
the no-look
get
pass.
The ball off. And yeah, and I
really
think
he plays an uninhibited form of football.
He does. It's like this vigor about him, and the way he just has a feel too. Like, he's not thinking, I think I'm going to do a little sidearm. I mean, it's just, he's so immediate to what is happening. And I think that is definitely mirrored in the larger culture of people finding more space for their authentic voice, for their authentic self, for not being conformist, for kind of doing it their own way. And that's going to be an interesting thing to see how it plays out in football, because football has not generally been an arena where, and, you know, kind of unique individuals were welcome.
It's a conformist sport.
Yeah. And so, you know, it'll just be kind of interesting to see how that plays out in a sport like football.
So lastly, predictions for the game. Marcia was the one right last year. She did go with the Eagles, whereas John and I refused to. We thought, no way you can bet against Tom Brady. So Tom Brady's back. Do we still want to bet against Tom Brady in this game or the Rams? You've said the Rams have the most talented roster in the NFL.
Yeah. You know, I think a guy for the Rams who's been underrated is their general manager is a good guy named Les Snead, and he hasn't gotten as much credit as they deserve because their roster is unbelievable. Their defensive line, I'm not sure anybody could block them. Having said that, well, I lost last year. that means that I won't lose this year. I don't know how you bet against Tom Brady.
I'm going to. I'm betting against Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. All the way, baby.
I think I'm with John again. And if I win,
you guys are taking me out to dinner this year. Last year, I didn't get anything.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well, @ShoopsGoingDeep.